around here.
Captain! Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Say it.
I'm Ben Harrison.
I bet you've wanted to say that for a long time, huh?
Felt weird, but also good.
Let me tell you something, Ben. You're going to have to kill me first and then wear me as a skin suit, you sick fuck.
Is that how it works? You covet what you're close to?
I've seen enough episodes of Dateline NBC to know that the first suspect in any podcast host's murder is the co-host.
Yeah.
So you better be good at covering up your tracks, man.
Is there any room in your heart, Adam, for more Star Trek than already exists in the world?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like the reverse Grinch. My heart grows sizes in proportion to the new Star Trek show announcements.
You're like Star Trek polyamorous. Love is a renewable resource. Time is a finite resource.
That's it exactly. Yeah.
You want that new Trek energy.
I want to fuck all the Treks. Clearly. I have room in my bed for them all, Ben.
One weird thing about doing these podcasts is like news, you know, they're not like super timely, obviously, and we're on a schedule, so news breaks, and I don't want to like blow my load spouting off my opinion on Twitter.
But, yeah, you want to blow your load on me.
But then like 700 people tweet me things about news that's breaking, and I'm like, I don't want to be like weird and rude and not respond to you, but I also like have a place for that. It's not here.
Oh, it's not responding to Trek Fan 69 or whatever.
That's one of the best Trek fans, though.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's also me. You should know that. That's my alternate.
One of your many shadow puppet accounts.
Yeah, it's the only way I can use Twitter anymore.
Wow. But there's news, right? They've announced the name of the new Picard series. It's Star Trek : Picard.
Oh, there's a colon in that title? That actually concerns me greatly, given what we know of things with colons from our hit podcast, Friendly Fire.
And it's going to be on CBS All Access in the US and Amazon Prime everywhere else. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's kind of an unusual twist of the knife.
Well, I mean, it doesn't affect us much, I guess.
It doesn't, but it's got to be a little bit irritating for our overseas friends. I mean, not as irritating as using CBS All Access.
Sure. I mean, they've got that going for them.
Yeah.
So I would say that they're doing all right.
But if you want to keep up with all the new Trek, you have multiple streaming services to pay a monthly subscription to now if you're not a US person. Maybe that's why CBS did it that way. Maybe they don't want to like make anybody not them too much of a Star Trek juggernaut.
I am reluctant to put myself in the head of anyone who is on a board of directors for a publicly traded company.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the hell these people are thinking.
It's probably the board of directors that decides that, right?
I can tell you one thing. This Picard show is going to be a huge hit. Like, it has to be, right? It's a license to print Latinum. It is it's going to be massive. It's going to be the biggest thing that CBS All Access has ever done, right? Like, that seems to be a safe bet.
It does. I talked to a television producer one time when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was first about to drop, and he said something that sounds very similar to that. Like they have too much on the line for that show not to be successful.
It
one way or another, they will make that show successful.
Whether you like it or not, this is going to be successful.
Did you ever watch that show?
No, because I've never like outside of the X-Men cartoon, my enjoyment of the Marvel properties on television is fairly limited. And actually in movies too. Like I'm not a huge Marvel Cinematic Universe guy.
Yeah, I still haven't seen Adventures and Games.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's great. People seem to like it.
Yeah.
I'll see it eventually on the back of a, you know, a TV and on the airplane kind of a deal.
Yeah.
The way the director intended.
Yeah. Peeking over a pile of empty tray table cocktail glasses.
Yeah, staring down it at a bad angle because the person in front of me leaned their seat back.
Yeah, that's great.
But we don't really know much beyond that, do we?
I mean, we have one screen grab, and then we have a title card.
The screen grab has a TNG-ish uniform in it, which is fun.
And what I am arguing is an action jacket. Though we don't see the bottom, it could be buttoned in a cardigan style fashion. It looks like it has the shoulders and the construction of a jacket to me.
Yeah. There is always a three-letter abbreviation for Star Trek shows. Is this one going to be Stone Temple Pilots?
I mean, yeah, it has to be. It's as obvious to me as Star Trek Picard was as a title. Like, how could you even think of naming this anything else?
Yeah, I mean, no surprise there, but also...
But also, we were told that wouldn't be the title, and like everything else dribbling out of the Star Trek industrial complex, not to be believed.
Don't believe anything. They're fucking liars. They're a pack of dirty liars.
I think I said this before on some other show. I'm fine being lied to. Like this is the relationship I'm okay with between me and big Star Trek. Like. I am happy to be surprised when TNG cast members appear on the show after being told that they wouldn't be. Like, I'm fine with that. Lie to me. Super fine with it.
Wow. Well, it's all very exciting, but it's not really what we came here to talk about today, is it?
We're going to do a show about this show, right? We're going to do a Picard show?
Oh, you know, I really think that this podcast, this current podcast that we are on, I would ride for changing the name of it to something a little bit more all-inclusive and having it just be the show we use to talk about new Star Trek things.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's a pain in the ass. We have to change the logo and...
We could call it A New Star Trek, but it's A-N-U-S, and then next line, Tar Trek, as the title.
That's how you make yourself rise in the search rankings.
Ain't a Star Trek. From the brilliant minds that brought you The Greatest Discovery and The Greatest Generation.
I want to know who isn't searching for Anus Tar Trek.
Yeah, I don't know what to call it. I feel like it needs a catchy name.
Don't send us your ideas.
I want them to come from us.
Yeah.
I think the working title might be Anus Star Trek.
You're such an idiot. Well,
cut to the inside of my brain and it's just like four blinking Christmas lights on a string of like 200.
We're burned out. Adam, speaking of buttholes, there's the implication of space buttholes in the Star Trek Discovery thing we're going to be talking about today. Do you want to get into it?
Yeah, I do. It's back to comics, Ben. It's the Star Trek Discovery off-season, and today we are beginning to read Star Trek Discovery Captain Saru.
The Discovery annual comic book that IDW puts out. Like, the first page is fucking confusing, is it not?
Yeah, it is.
It gives you nothing to hang your hat on, W/R/T dream sequence. And I read this on my iPad and I wondered, was this page opposing the next page or did you have to turn to get to the next page? Because I feel like if I'd seen these the colors on this page and the colors on the next page next to each other, I might have like done the mental math of this is a dream.
That's fair.
But this is a scene in which Saru is talking about blueberries being the spore drive on Discovery is powered.
Kind of sounds like that might have been a first draft, like a wink back at the writer's room. Like, remember for a hot minute where it was blueberries? Sure glad we didn't go with that idea.
That's fun.
Yeah, the desaturated colors of this page are the only indication that this might be a dream. That and the idea that Saru would ever eat the contents of the spore drive, which is what he's doing here.
Yeah, we know that makes you trip balls. So then that also occurred to me was, is he having like a mushroom trip?
We know factually that the mushrooms are very minty tasting and not fruity tasting.
Yeah. Well, he wakes up. He's being summoned by Michael Burnham, and they go to the Louvre in Paris.
These are two characters that belong in a museum. Ben.
Yeah, a Paris landmark that has not been destroyed recently.
It's very in keeping with Star Trek commenting on its own characters that for their free time, our main characters would be interested in the consumption of high culture, right? Art and culture. These are two characters that are not interested in the many culinary delights of a Paris, clearly.
Well, this is just one part of their vacation that we see. Because they're on shore leave. This is, I guess, this is set in between the events of the end of the Klingon War and them heading to Vulcan to get a new captain, right?
Yeah, the very first page, like on the title page of this comic, it says pretty clearly we're in between seasons for this story.
It's not even quite in between seasons because... I mean, they run into the Enterprise at the end of season one. So this is actually within an elliptical edit in the last episode of season one.
Oh, yeah. The story takes place after the events of season one of Star Trek Discovery, before the arrival of the Enterprise. There you go.
So they're talking about what this dream means. And Saru is unwilling to entertain that it has anything to do with anything other than being scared of everything all the time.
I feel like if you were to draw Data's head on Saru's body, this all sounds like Data to me, you know? Hmm. Like Saru being the Data of Star Trek Discovery. His lack of understanding of things like a dream life and his need for those things to be interpreted by a human companion.
However, unlike Saru, Data's ganglia are fully functional and programmed in multiple techniques.
Right. Yeah, this is pre-loss of ganglia Saru also, so he still possesses that timidity of a pre-pubescent Kelpian.
We know so much more about him than he knows about himself.
Right, and that is a weird place to engage this story, I think, because for the entire run of both the show and the comics, you and I have come to the story with fresh eyes.
Right.
Like seeing things totally new.
Yeah. Well, anyways, they're checking out the Winged Victory of Samothrace, a sculpture in the Louvre that's, probably a Greek sculpture, right?
It's a
head knocked off of a winged lady body.
It's Nike. It's the Hellenistic sculpture of Nike.
Wow. To Saru, it very adventurously represents Starship Discovery.
Yeah, Nike was the Greek goddess of victory, Ben.
Yeah. This is like my childhood friend Brian, who had very bad asthma, got a dog that was hypoallergenic, and they named their dog Nike because it was like a big victory for him to be well enough for them to get a dog.
The dog was also a headless dog?
No! She was a nice dog. She had a head.
There are plenty of nice dogs without heads, Ben.
How would you know whether they're nice or not when they're dead?
I don't know. Anyway, this comparison to the Discovery doesn't end there. The Discovery is also without a head, Ben. It's without a captain.
It's like a metaphor, man.
And Michael's riding pretty hard for the idea of Saru being that captain.
I thought this was so interesting because in my head, it has always been a question whether she would get the promotion before him, given that she used to be the first officer of the Shenzhou that he reported to. And they've kind of flipped roles in her post being in trouble for mutiny days. But she really advocates for the idea that he's ready and he's the one it should be.
What do you make of her career martyrdom? You know, like her job experience seems pretty strong.
Yeah.
But she does not seem to possess that kind of ambition. She never gives voice to that, ever.
Right.
Wonder why.
I get the feeling that she does want to be a captain, but I wonder if it's like part of her kind of Vulcan aspect to her personality where she's just doing the math really dispassionately and she's saying like, I would like to be a captain, but he's like in a position to be a better captain right now or something like that.
I'm struggling to recall a moment in time where Michael was not always the XO with another opinion or another course of action to offer to a leader or a captain. It would be very different to see her as someone for whom those are given instead of the giver, right? So much for her personality is that.
Have we ever seen her get left in the captain's chair? Like, I feel like we've seen Arium in the captain's chair more than we've seen Michael.
Yeah, that's strange, and it seems intentional.
We go up to the space dock where the disco is being patched back together, and it's like most of the big items are crossed off the to-do list, but there's still a long way to go, and so we get a little round the horn checking in on where different people are. Tilly is on another starship visiting her father.
Stamets is visiting Hugh Culber's parents at a family Mexican restaurant.
Are you just saying that based on the color palette?
No, I'm just saying that that's a thing that people do.
Yeah.
You know, you meet the parents-in-law at their restaurant of choice. Often that restaurant is a family Mexican restaurant.
That's certainly my in-law's restaurant of choice.
Yeah.
Owo, climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah, like putting a third notch in her Everest headboard, I guess. Yeah.
Do you think that that's kind of like a basic mountain to climb in a universe where you can travel to lots of different planets?
In a future universe, it's probably not the challenge that is the attraction. It's the idea of going to clean it, probably. You see the little frame of her chiseling a frozen piece of shit out of a rock face? I've done my part.
But Admiral Bob gives Saru a job. There is a ship that has gone missing.
It's the USS Dorothy Garrad.
There are two different parts in this comic so far that I spotted like references to Star Trek Discovery novels. And this ship is apparently a ship that plays a part in one of the Star Trek Discovery novels. I looked up Dorothy Garrad. She's the first woman to ever hold an Oxbridge chair. She was like a paleontologist or something.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see what footnotes look like in comic books.
Yeah.
They do this a couple times. You're right. They'll throw an asterisk there, and then they'll drop a box that say, like, this is referring to a novel
Yeah.
or whatever.
I feel like they are doing that more in this than I am accustomed to. Like the previous comics we've read, there, I guess, wasn't as much ancillary media to draw on.
Yeah.
And they didn't need to situate it in time because it was pretty obvious where in time it was taking place.
Right. Bob is sending Saru out on a rescue mission because the Garrad they've lost contact with the Garrad. And Tilly's on board that ship, as we learned through the vignettes of people taking their shore leave. And she sort of pitches it as a test of Saru's ability as a captain.
Yeah.
Saru's like, look, this ship is not exactly the perfect choice for this because everyone's away and it's still being repaired. So a lot of the systems don't work and we're not at a full crew complement. And Admiral
Right.
Bob like turns that into a positive. She's like, well, look, we're going to view this as a like job application, basically. Like we're going to be judging you based on your ability to do this mission. So
we're going
to
be kicking your captain tires.
Yeah. So like you go out with the crew that you've got, not the crew that you want.
She recommends that that he take Burnham with him. He agrees with that, and off they go. So it's kind of the idea is that it's a bit of a skeleton crew. They're not going out with a full crew complement.
Yeah.
They're not recalling everyone.
Right.
But the Garad is studying like a weird nebula, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is described as a migratory pocket nebula. So like Michael Burnham is kind of using a lot of the same excuses that I do for not going to see the doctor. Mm-hmm. Just like, I'm sure it's fine. Like rub some dirt on it. It'll be like, you know, like we're going to head out there. We're going to find that the Garad is there. And it's just interference with its communication systems because of the nebula.
It's hard enough to find the pocket nebula as it is without it being migratory, Ben.
Mm, yeah. Well, I try to stay out of the pocket nebula.
Right. So they arrive, they find the ship outside the nebula, and they get kind of...
Easiest search mission of all time.
Yeah, they basically go directly there. And they're greeted with kind of a sparky, staticky FaceTime with Tilly, who's warning them of an ambush. And then as soon as they sort of parse that information, 6 transporter signals appear on sensors and they're gone. Like the ship is empty. And Saru, having heard that Tilly's message is sort of like ambush adjacent, is like, hey, Michael, why don't you just go over there and inspect what the deal is? Like, the idea of putting shields up or going on alert in any way is not top of mind. It's like, go investigate.
I'm not really sure what you would do other than go check it out. But
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get much information about what the Disco is doing, W/R/T shields or some kind of readiness posture.
Yeah.
Which I feel like I would have liked one little frame where he says, like, yellow alert shields. Yeah. So Michael beams over with a Dustbuster Club, and they're in, like, body armor with, like, full phaser rifles.
Yeah, and they do that thing where they beam over in a semicircle with phasers pointed out. That's fun.
I always love that. And the place is empty. It's a dump. It looks kind of... It's like a car up on blocks in a bad neighborhood. Like, all of the good stuff has been taken out of this ship.
Yeah, they got the dangling cables.
And it's not long that they're over there before they start getting phasered to death. And I didn't quite get this, like whether people were actually getting killed.
Yeah, it seems like in a comic book context, if the beam goes through the body, I'm seeing that as dead.
Yeah. But then I was also confused because like there's a quick little action scene and then we're back on the bridge of the Disco and... They say, like, there were 10 transporter signals, and Saru is like, well, that means there were 5 hostiles that beamed aboard and escaped with our security team, except for we saw 6 people beam over from the Discovery initially.
Right.
So does that mean that they know one person died, or what?
I don't know, man.
I'm just baffled by, like, some of the math here.
Yeah, it's unclear at this point if that math is going to come up later. In a missing person kind of way.
Yeah. Suddenly the communications problems don't seem to be affecting them as much because a voice kind of shows up on the bridge and then in short order is accompanied by a hologram.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. We get Vera, who's an Orion woman, responsible for taking the crew and stripping the ship for parts. I just... always have liked space piracy stories in Star Trek. It feels like we get very few of them.
Wasn't there like a Gene Roddenberry proscription against space pirate stories?
Well, that was one of the ways that he was wrong, if so, because this is a very fun kind of story to tell, and it's neat to see it in this Discovery universe.
Yeah. So this is, she's one of those green people.
Vera's holding all the cards.
Yeah. She's got hostages.
She seems a little bit incredulous about the ship that she's hooked in her trap. It seems to be a little bit bigger than she was expecting. Like, she mentions that.
A better prize than she anticipated. Like, this was an attempt to draw another Starfleet vessel out so that she could take it over, essentially.
Yeah, and she's talking about materiel and people in terms of their relative value. She tells Saru that he's got nothing to worry about. W/R/T, the condition of her hostages, because she knows that healthy hostages are more valuable on the market.
I liked how Saru is, like, even in this context, assumes good faith. Like, he's yeah. like, how are you cloaking your ship? How are you doing this hologram right now? And she's like, why would I tell you that?
Yeah, he seems more interested in the science than he is about the emergency.
Yeah, and for that reason, they have, like, a pretty long conversation. Like, she is hologramming around the bridge for pages and pages. And yeah, the idea is it's a bargain. Like, she wants to be paid for everything she's taken.
I like that she does a little bit on her way off of the bridge. She could just snap her fingers and end communication, but instead she turns little and then disappears on on the chair, on the command chair. It's fun. And they sort of, like, they write the text of her dialogue shrinking in proportion to her.
Yeah.
I like to imagine she's getting a little chipmunky at the end.
Why not make yourself shrink if you're a hologram?
Right? That's great.
We get Michael Burnham being thrown into the holding cell of the Orions by some shirtless green men.
Mm-hmm.
Who Michael Burnham calls little green men, but they look pretty burly to me. They look like they're fairly big green men.
Yeah.
Like men, green men that you would not want to pick a fight with at a bar.
No, they're Hulkmen.
Yeah.
Almost. Inside this holding cell, Michael Burnham meets the captain of the Dorothy Garad, and this is Captain Holden.
Yeah.
Who has kind of a Admiral Bob like Bob going.
Don't show this comic book to John Roderick.
Yeah. Yeah, they're in the brig along with Tilly and wondering how the hell they're going to get out of this mess. Tilly feeling pretty bad about her responsibility. It was her idea to investigate the nebula.
Yeah.
I think this is a feeling that Michael Burnham probably knows really well, who for a long time felt like it was her fault that her parents died when they were doing experiments near that star supernova.
Yeah. Did you notice that Captain Holden didn't have the, like, gold shoulder detail that other captain uniforms have?
Yeah, that's weird, right?
I wonder if
she's, because she's on a lesser vessel.
Yeah, she's like on a science vessel. Maybe she isn't.
Yeah.
Maybe she's like the captain of the ship, but not technically a captain in rank or something like that.
Was it your understanding that this was Tilly's dad's ship?
Yeah, but he must have a job not captain on it.
I wonder if that's going to be where the story goes. Because
yeah.
Papa Tilly does not appear in the first half of the comic.
They do appear to be doing a gender segregated holding cell situation on this Orion installation or spaceship.
With how sexualized the Orions are, I kind of understand that from them. That makes sense.
I guess they're saying it's a ship, right? Because they say, like, who builds a ship out of actual metal? It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Unless they're confused about where they are and they're not on a ship. Maybe they beamed far, far away.
Maybe. Well, that is where we stop, right?
Yeah, there's sort of a moment of hope. This is the break in the comic where people feel like hope might be lost, but Michael Burnham says the discovery is still out there, so there's a chance.
So you're saying there's a chance?
Wait a minute. What was all that one in a million talk?
What'd you think of the first half of this comic book, Ben? Did it hold your attention? Does it have you excited for the second half?
I am excited for the second half. I'm not sure. Is this the same artist as we've seen before?
I know it's the same. It's Kirsten Bayer still, who's running the story. So in that way, it is. It's all connected. But the artwork does look in keeping with everything else. This is Angel Hernandez, who does the art here, and I want to say that's the same artist who's done the other disco books we've read.
Angel Hernandez, or Angel, maybe, did the previous Star Trek Discovery annual, so yeah. Same inkist. But I think I like the drawings a little bit better in this one than the previous ones. I feel like it's a lot moodier and feels a little bit more set in the world. And I wonder if that's maybe just a creative choice based on where in the timeline this takes place.
Yeah.
But it was fun to read, fun to look at. And I am very curious to see what Saru does, because it does seem like Saru maybe took a needless risk in beaming an away team over to that ship. So if he's trying to make himself look Starfleet captain material, this would be a problem that he needs to solve fairly urgently, but also save everybody's life.
Would you like the chances of mission success here if this were post-pubescent Saru?
Yes.
Me too.
I feel like he would have already killed everybody on the Orion ship.
Yeah. I mean, if not killed, aggressively pursued.
This would be a comic book about Saru's trial for wildly overreacting.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked the first half too, Ben. I really like every frame where we have the ship or the pair of ships, I think especially, looks really good. I like when the ships are backlit and then they cast shadows on other ships.
Yeah.
I think they do a good job of that in this book. And also, sometimes you'll read these comics and the characters won't look like themselves in a frame or two.
Yeah.
I feel like all of the depictions are really photorealistic and good.
Yeah, they really nailed them.
Yeah.
Do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages, Adam?
Yeah.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Christina Waddle. It's for Ryan Brody. The message goes like this. Happy 40th birthday, Ryan. My husband and my best friend. We are in challenging times, building a career, raising kids, paying a mortgage, and the other demands of life. Thank goodness for Star Trek reruns. After the kids are in bed, you are a wonderful husband and father. I look forward to the next stages of life together. And in parentheses, Christina Waddle says that Ryan was at the Vancouver show.
Cool.
40, huh? I know that feeling, Ryan.
Yeah.
Just got there myself.
You and Ryan are the same age.
It's true. It's really true. When are you going to be 40, Ben? 6 years from now?
5 years from now. Less than 5 years. 4 and a bit.
Wow. Wow. I often forget I am so, so, so much older than you.
Yeah, you were already out of high school by the time I got there.
Yeah.
You would have hated me at that age. I would have given you a run for your money, because I hated myself at that age, too.
Everyone in high school is hateable, Ben.
Yeah. We have another Priority One message here, Adam. It's from Brandon. It's to Straight Mike. And this is requested that I do it in a Vokescent.
Oh, boy.
Dear Mike, happy birthday! Since we are not the type of friends who hug each other, consider this your birthday hug. Feels good, doesn't it? Thank you for introducing me to the Uxbridge Shimodaverse. You are the Ben to my Adam. Because you wear glasses and are tall, and I am always using the bathroom. Kapla!
That is a delight.
I added my kapla at the end.
I love Voke voice.
That
one of the
fun.
Great voices.
Yeah. I wish, it took me a while to warm up to the NU umlaut Klingons.
Uh-huh.
But now I wish they were all Klingons.
Yeah, I do too. That's weird, right?
Yeah, they're the definitive Klingons to me now.
Yeah, we really came around to the other side. Well, if you have a Priority One message for us to read in any kind of voice, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages are $100 and commercial messages are $200, both of which help keep the show going and support the greatest discovery.
And a happy birthday to one and all.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself a drunk Shimoda in this comic book?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
I did, Adam. I'm going to give it to Tilly for being in jail and yet nerding out about metallurgy.
Hmm.
It seems like her primary concern is the construction materials the Orions have chosen and not how to get out, how to get out of the bind.
Ben, mine is Tilly too. But it's because she took shore leave, like, by working. She kind of did the busman's holiday. Like,
she really
she's
did.
She's even in a uniform when they find her in that Orion jail. So, like, she was clearly there working. That doesn't seem like a fun shore leave.
She is driven. She's doing that thing that a lot of young people do, which is work themselves to the bone.
Yeah.
Gotta recharge the bats from time to time.
I didn't take summers off. Once I started working, I never stopped.
Yeah.
I guess until now. Well, this is fun, Ben.
Yeah.
First half of a long comic book. I love off-season Star Trek Discovery episodes for that reason. It gives us a chance to get into some media that we weren't able to while the show was on.
Yeah, I genuinely really enjoy this, and I hope people are sticking with us. If you enjoy this, tell your friends about The Greatest Discovery, soon to be maybe having a different name.
Soon to be a new Star Trek podcast. Fuck, that's gonna stick, isn't it?
No,
we've got to come up with something better.
We cannot have that.
Okay, yeah, it's got to be something better. Please
send your suggestions to people that aren't us. I guess we'll throw to Rob's from here.
Here's what you can send us. Artwork for the never going to happen a new Star Trek podcast. I would like to see what you guys come up with.
I would like to see the
logo.
Album art of that for sure.
Yeah. All right, Robs, take it from here, dude.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to support the ongoing production of our show. And a nice free way to support the show is to head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. All right, thanks. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.